going to go in a slightly different direction. We are not going to really talk that quantitative in this presentation. We're going to step back a little bit and look at some of the formative work we've been doing, specifically in North Carolina. I do want to recognize a couple of our co-authors, one of whom just walked in. Carla Semeta is one of the co-authors on this presentation, but also manuscript that is actually in review currently. And Jaime Montaño, with enthusiasm, Jaime. Actually, Jaime works very closely with, we work very closely together in North Carolina, and he's really part of everything that I do, at least the research that I'm part of, with the Latino community, and he really deserves most of the credit of any of the successes that we have in North Carolina. And then there's some other co-authors there as well, but they're not here, so we don't need to think about them right now. What we really wanted to do with this study is look at the intersections of immigration, masculinity, and sexual risk among Latino men. There's very little out there, and we actually contend that anything that's existing around HIV and sexual behavior and sexual risk, it has some pertinence, but is not necessarily generalizable to the folks that we're that are folks that are immigrating to the Southeast. They tend to be a little bit different from communities that have had more traditional, longer-term immigration in the past. The folks we work with tend to come from southern Mexico and Central America. We wanted to identify the potential determinants of sexual risk among more recently arrived immigrant Latino men, and we wanted to use photo voice to do this. And I don't know how many of you all are familiar with photo voice as a methodology, but it's very closely associated with community-based participatory research. And the idea for us was that as a white man who is not an immigrant to the United States, doesn't have issues related to documentation, isn't working in some of the same kinds of work, that we wanted to really make, and then Jaime too, who's been in the United States for a longer period of time, we really wanted to step back and say, okay, we want to develop a methodology that will completely be capture the lived experiences of these men, where these men actually, that we are making no assumptions about their experiences, and that they are informing the process along the research process, but very much part of the analysis and interpretation. And so this methodology lends itself very nicely to this. And we wanted to sit down with community representatives and really create a model of sexual behavior that was truly embedded, and we could point to what we know, or they could point to what they were experiencing, and know that it was really rooted in their lived experiences, and it was just really developing local theory. So the context in which we did this work, we did it in the, I guess, fall of 2004, and we did it in Forsyth County. Wake Forest University is in Forsyth County, and Forsyth County is a small county of a little over 300,000 residents. And just about, I don't know, I think, right, if you were to look at official data, maybe 10%, 9% Latino-Hispanic at this point. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is how recently the community has arrived. And the important thing is the growth of that community. North Carolina, lots of people don't realize, was at one point the fastest growing Latino community in the country. And that was between 1990 and 2000 census. That has changed. We're about third right now. Our total numbers are small, but the growth is tremendous. And it's exciting, but it's also challenging because we don't have that history. Our service industries or our health department, that kind of thing, it's very hard to get services because we don't have bilingual services. We don't have sort of the infrastructure, and we're having to make changes very quickly, which creates lots of challenges when someone wants to access care. We also rank third in Forsyth County ranks third in the state for its HIV case rate, which is about double the North Carolina's rate. So it's clearly a community that there's lots of work to be done. We also, just give you a little bit more context, have had pretty high syphilis rates as well. So we've sort of been one of the sites of really focusing on syphilis elimination because of it's just amazing and unfortunate rates. So what we really wanted to do is we have a working partnership that has a variety of studies focused on using sort of a CBPR approach or community-based participatory research approach. And one of the hallmarks of CBPR is informing research with local knowledge. So we really do look at the literature, we really work to understand what's going on, but we really want to make sure that we really do justice to the formative work and to the experiences of the men we're working with. Currently, we actually have this partnership has about 5 research studies federally funded, 3 from NIH, 1 from CDC, and 1 that's, Foundation. The 5th one's a Foundation funded. So not all of these organizations are always involved in every single research study or practice improvement kind of study that we work in, but these are pretty much those who come around the table. Keys to those are three aid service organizations, local county public health departments, we have a community college, a historically black university, and Wake Forest University. Now, I've been at Wake Forest University for about 4 years, and it's been a huge challenge as far as for Wake Forest to work within communities, but we've been very fortunate within the Latino community because we haven't already burned our bridges. So we're trying to be very respectful, and I, as a sort of a university person, have been really working really hard that we don't burn the bridges like we have in a lot of research institutions, especially reaching out to other vulnerable populations. So we've had tremendous success to date, and I don't take actually the credit of that. I really take the credit goes to the committed partners who care about the health issues of vulnerable populations in our area. So we really do focus on defining priorities at the community level in partnership with community members, priority setting, developing research designs and methods that are true to the community experience, evaluation, data analysis and interpretation in partnership with community members, and really making plans for dissemination together. So I'm going to go into the Photo Voice study, and a lot of you nodded your heads about familiarity with Photo Voice, so we won't talk too much about that, and if there are questions or comments later, that's great. We really worked with a CBO partner to recruit men from 3 different public housing communities, or housing communities, to participate in this study. And it was an amazing process because we have pretty good, I see it as very good. Jaime gets frustrated because it's not perfect, but we have pretty good recruitment rates in all of our studies, and that a lot has to do with our community, our CBPR approach. In this study, we had a 1-hour introductory meeting to really talk about what Photo Voice is, the ethics of and safety in photography, and until you grab a camera and take pictures of things happening in your neighborhood or your household that aren't just about smiling before a birthday cake, taking pictures is pretty difficult actually, and so it's a challenge to go into a community and just start taking pictures, even if you're a member of that community. So we talk about those kinds of issues. We talk about informed consent in case they're taking pictures of folks who are actually in the photos or recognizable in the photos. Talk about camera operation and just sort of the process. So folks were compensated $10 gift card for each of their of the sessions attended. And we had one when we recruited our participants. We had multiple sessions, and we had no dropout at all. It took some effort to make sure that we were doing it when people could make it and Saturday mornings to work, but it was an amazing process to go through. Participants got a disposable camera for each photo assignment. They were really just charged with taking 4 to 5 photos about the theme that they decided or the photo assignment that they decided, and then they could use the camera to take any other pictures they wanted. And so we were developing that film for them. giving, you know, giving the envelope with the photos to them, and then when we came, when they came back to the photo discussion, they could choose whether to even talk about any photos at all or not. So it was very much of trying to make sure that the power is held by the community members. And that's hard to do when you have funded studies, and it's hard to do when you have a strong personality, a PI like me, but the partners really help it all happen. So we also collected some very basic demographic data about our participants, age, self-identified race, ethnicity, country of origin, years of formal education, number of months since arrival in the United States, employment status, partnership status in the United States, and that's sort of where they are accompanied or not accompanied, whether they're living with someone or not living with someone, and their sexual behavior. Like Photo Voice is typically done, it is a small group, and the key to the process is not numbers of participants, but it's the data that's collected over time. So the fact that I engage in this process, I open up, it leads to new areas. That's really what we were going for. So we had three men from the three different communities. Mean age was 23. This is our young group. I totally forgot that this is our young group. Okay, I have a lot of research going on, so it's sort of it's interesting. So 18 to 29, the countries of origin were El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico. Numbers of months since arriving, just about a year. Formal education, as you see, you know, sort of a little bit diverse, but so the way the process works is the participants sort of understand the process, understand what the cameras are for, and then decide what they want to take pictures on. So these were their photo assignments. So at each session, they would decide what they're taking pictures for the next session. So the first one was community strengths, then it was education, then it was services, and it was HIV/AIDS prevention. So it's sort of interesting because the group, because you sort of walk away, and I've been doing Photo Voice for a while, so I guess I'm a little bit more trusting of the process, but it's difficult at the very beginning because you think education, gosh, what are they going to take pictures of? How will they interpret that for the photo assignment? But of course, the real key is talking about the photos. So the process of talking about the photos brings out a lot of great information. So they were held on Saturday mornings. It was a very convenient location. Sessions really lasted maybe about a little under 2 hours. We audio recorded those sessions, so the discussion was if you're familiar with sort of focus group and people are reacting to one another and discussing, it's that kind of thing. Breakfast was provided. The photo voice process, if you go to sort of the literature, you get, I think, an 8 or 6 step process. I don't remember. And we've done that before, but we've really brought it down to these 4 questions because it can get a little repetitive. I guess it's 6 is what traditionally done in the literature, but we brought it down to these 4 just because it seems to simplify the process, it seems to cut to the chase, and it seems to get the information that we were really looking for. So, what do you see? And that's sort of the first line of inquiry when someone is showing a photo, like, what's going on in this photo visually? How do you feel about what's going on in that photo? What do you think about this? So, I'm feeling this, I see this, I'm feeling this, and then what do I think about it? I think it's wrong. I think it affects the way I feel. I think that it makes me mad. I think that we have to do something about it. And that would get into what can we do. So we recorded those transcripts, or the discussions. So we had 4 discussions plus a sort of a supplemental follow-up discussion just to sort of process through what we had been talking about. And we had an ad hoc committee of the partnership to really start the preliminary analysis and interpretation. But I think it's really important to know that we did not the part of what we were really focused on is that the participants were really involved in this process. So although all the participants couldn't put the time or have the time even to go to every meeting or to read every transcript, that type of thing, we did several sessions, I believe 4, in which once we had preliminary themes that they looked at those themes and put it all together. So the nine participants really created the model that I'm about to show you. I think I'm about to show you. I want to make sure that that's where we are. I'm not missing something. So I think we are there. So this is the model that our participants, the partners, came up with. And this is what they were saying is, I want to create a model that really explains my experience. My experience may be very different if I were in California. It may be very different if I were in Texas. It may be very different if I were even on the eastern side of the state of North Carolina. But this is the way they saw risk behavior and HIV or sexual risk within what is going on for them. So you'll see at the top, there's sort of decreased power and increased stress. So what they identified is sort of this domain of immigration. So they're tight borders. I came to the United States. I gave up a lot to be here. Then I have to deal with this, and so that's hard. Then I have to deal with discrimination and prejudice, and so that's hard. And so then I have this really bad substandard housing, and that creates more stress for me. Then I have this really bad working condition, and I feel like I have no rights, and I can't do anything about it. So what they were really – and then I don't even know if I have access to care. I don't know where I'm going to go if I have a question. So the idea is that this whole sort of domain of immigration experience is leading to both decreased power and increased stress. On the other side of that, although one could say, well, why isn't masculinity just part of that immigration experience? They really wanted to look at this as give it its own focus. So it's sort of an equal circle within this model. So the idea that you come to the United States and you have to take on untraditional roles. For example, and you all have lots of examples, I'm sure, but we had a participant who was from Guatemala, and he said, you know what? Before I came here, I never had to really deal with money. I never had to manage money. That was what, in my community back home, the women dealt with money. So my father would come home from work, or he would have his money or be paid, and it would go into his mother would handle it. So coming to the United States, and I like this example because it cross-cuts what even our own perceptions of what's masculine and feminine sort of roles or divisions of labor. So I like that example a lot. And then the frustration of not meeting, so it's sort of, I have to take on these untraditional roles, and so that's hard, and then I'm not meeting what I think I should be doing, and so that's hard. And so those sort of came together for these men as these are what we're dealing with, this is our frustration. Then the bottom two circles really identify sort of some assets. Latino community assets, friendship, family networks. One of the big projects that Jaime does or has done is work with the soccer leagues for HIV prevention. So using the soccer league as a social network for lay health advisors, disseminating information. So that's an example of these amazing networks. Well, I guess it's on the chart. and then on the other side is the other, not Latino community strengths, but just community strengths, that there are Latinos serving, and perhaps they're run by Latinos, but perhaps they're not, and Latino promoting organizations, as well as there's jobs. So those are sort of good things. And those, what they, these men were suggesting is those help deal with those other stresses and decreased power, that kind of thing. So that's the model that this partnership came up with and that these men came up with. Now, what's really key is our purpose in this study was to get a really authentic idea of where these men were in their mindset about risk, because I can come up with all crazy kinds of ideas, and I can run to the literature, and I can pull some constructs out, and then I can go out and do a quantitative assessment and test all that and create a model. But we really wanted to say, okay, we're gonna look at the literature, and we're gonna pull things from previous knowledge, but we want to look at what these men are saying is going on for them right here in North Carolina. So I just wanted to pull out a couple quotations. I think I have a couple more minutes, maybe. Okay. All of these changes and a change in our status make us feel small and without power. And another participant noted that he was a school teacher in El Salvador, and here I'm seen as unskilled labor. So if you think about sort of those, what we just talked about, when you think of that immigration circle, this really illustrates that process or that feeling. And then, I love this quotation because I think it's really, it sort of brings it all together. Look at the model that we created. You can see some of the major influences on our behavior as men, and my behavior, or the sex behaviors and drinking of our friends. And I say many Latino men living in the United States, just like me. Living in the United States is difficult. Coming to the United States is difficult. We have to take new things on. Doing new things costs us. Difficulties are compounded. Things can be good, but coming here is difficult too. When things are difficult, men do not make the right decisions. I may take risks. Who thinks of a condom when one is trying to escape or prove oneself? Who thinks of a condom when pressure of life here is so great? And I think that's, we really need to start thinking, or maybe some people are thinking this way, but really focus on the idea of, when we think of certain populations, we say, okay, well, condom use has certain meanings. It means trust, it means love. So in what other kinds of sex has certain meanings? And so what does condom use do to those meanings? So what are the different purposes of sex, or the different, on both sides, what's influencing it and what does it mean? So sort of, you know, there are lots of implications. I just really wanted to touch on just a couple. We really wanted to look at, one of the things we wanted to really look at is the intersections between immigration, masculinity, and risk. And we really think that we were, you know, in the process that we engaged in, have a good sense that this is, for these 9 men, we worked out together a process that seemed authentic for them, a model that seemed authentic, using a good process. We also created a space for community participation and control over the process. So these men were able to mobilize, explore, describe, and analyze the challenges and assets and problem solve. So what is it? Where would you intervene? And I think it was an empowering process. And now is really, we're pulling pieces from the literature in our other studies, data from our other studies, and creating instrumentation that sort of includes some of this so we can actually start to look and make sure that we are creating models that explain most as much of the variance as possible. And then I love this quotation because participant commented, I'm the expert on my own life. You, practitioners, really talking to me, but may know a little bit, but I can tell you what's going on with me better than you can think, better than you may think. So I think that's really an important way to go. So I think it's really important that we start to, or that we continue to evolve as the epidemic evolves.